podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. Amy Martinez inching closer and closer to that 4th of July weekend. Before we start the show, some breaking news. As according to Hanzi Lo Wang from NPR, the Trump administration has decided to print the 2020 census forms without the citizenship question, and the printer has been told to start the printing process. So we'll have more on that a little later in the day. Coming up on today's show, we're going to talk about AB 730. That's California's proposed legislation to prohibit the distribution of deceptive audio or visual media of candidates running for office. We'll also find out more about a secret Facebook group for law enforcement where members are making disparaging comments about Muslims. That's coming up in about half an hour. But first, let's start the show on a lighter note with something that ended just minutes ago, and that's the Women's World Cup. The United States advances to the final after beating England 2-1. The U.S. took an early lead 10 minutes in when Kristen Press made a header.
Right side, cross, done, go! It is Press on it.
The final is Sunday morning, but it's Sweden versus the Netherlands tomorrow to figure out who'll play the defending champions, the United States. For more, we're joined by soccer writer Andrea Canales. So welcome back to Take 2.
Thank you, eh? It's good to be back.
Pretty exciting, too. That was a really, really good game to watch. I was kind of on pins and needles, biting my nails, whatever nails I have left, Andrea. But let's start off with right off the bat, because one of the things that we saw before the game even began, team captain Megan Rapinoe did not play in this game. She's nursing a hamstring injury. She scored 5 goals in 4 matches so far. She was in uniform, not able to play. She's going to have some time now to try and get there, but how surprising was it to not see her in the lineup right off the bat?
You know, I'm hoping that the hamstring isn't too bad, partly because it made a lot of sense to rest her for this match, which was, as you say, a barn burner end-to-end, close calls, penalty save. It had everything. And she is one of the older players on the team. She's also a co-captain, so it's not like the team didn't have leadership without her. So I kind of think, I mean, this U.S. team is really amazing. I've covered the team for a long time, and their depth is really one of their great assets because they go so deep. And Rapinoe is a singular type of player. She's very creative on the ball. That's something that not a lot of players still have in the women's game. She's a little bit like the team's Messi. In terms of what she can create, something out of nothing. And she's got just incredible mentality. Two of the goals that she scored were penalties in the last game. And as this game showed, it's not easy to score a penalty. It's definitely not as simple as a free throw in basketball or anything like that. Yeah.
And there were some amazing saves, Andrea, in this game. I mean, Team USA's goalkeeper was just absolutely on springs, it sounded like, or at least it seemed like. Would you say that this game was Team USA's biggest test so far in the Women's World Cup?
To a certain degree, it was their biggest test while they were playing their best. I would say against Spain, they weren't playing well, and that was a test for them to fight through when they were at times not the sharpest team, and they were kind of thrown off by Spain's willingness to foul a lot. But as far as them, the USA team, bringing their best to this game and getting matched in many levels of it by England, yes, I would say this was their best team game.
Now, Team USA waits to play tomorrow's winner between Sweden and the Netherlands. They beat Sweden in group play 2-0. Which squad, Andrea, poses the most danger for Team USA?
Well, the Sweden team that they beat in group play, it has to be said, wasn't Sweden's full strength team. And that's part of what Sweden does so well against the U.S., because in that group game, Sweden had already advanced, so they didn't have to put out their best lineup. And it could have been a little bit of strategy, thinking that if we meet the USA team later on, We don't want them to have knowledge of our team's best lineup. And so Sweden is a little bit of a bogey team for the U.S. They knocked the U.S. out of the Olympics, and they shouldn't on paper be the toughest opponent for the U.S., but they are. The Netherlands are a young, exciting team. They are the reigning world or the reigning European champions right now. Yeah. But I also think that they're a little bit untested on the world stage, and I think in some ways they would be an easier opponent for the U.S.
Now, while I got you, Andrea, we haven't talked soccer in a long time. I wanted to mention something about that happened right before the World Cup. USA coach Jill Ellis was criticized by former goalkeeper Hope Solo for a laundry list of reasons. She's not a good leader, she says. She cracks under pressure, and that USA's talent is so good that they win in spite of her. How much water does that hold to you about Jill Ellis?
I knew Jill Ellis back when she was coaching UCLA, and one thing that she definitely has her finger on the pulse of is the personality of the team. I think that I'm not going to argue with people about various tactics. Sometimes they're puzzling to me, but I think she understands what her team needs in terms of support. I remember when the team kind of led a player revolt against another coach that they feel just, you know, didn't understand them or work with them. They just felt it was a personality conflict between the team and the coach, and they basically got that coach replaced. So that was some time back. And I think, you know, so far the decision she's making, even this one about, you know, sitting Rapinoe, when a lot of people would think, oh, you know, she's been scoring so much.
Yeah, it's a risk. It's still a risk.
It is absolutely a risk, and it's paid off. I think you can't really argue with the World Cup record of a team that is, you know, at the same time, I was so happy to see the penalty save by Neyer, partly because Hope Solo and has kind of cast a shadow on this team with not only this kind of criticism, but just her personality. For many years has been so strong. It's been in some ways kind of the face and the whole persona of the team. And it's great it's been great in the past for the team because she is so confident. But I think it also made some people wonder, maybe even her teammates wonder, can we win without Hope?
Yeah.
Will any other, you know, goalkeeper be able to make those incredible saves? That
they have Hope without Hope Solo, for sure. That's exactly.
Yeah.
Now, one more thing on Megan Rapinoe, because politics sort of overshadowed the last couple of games. The day before they beat France, President Trump accused her of disrespecting the country for a video in which she said she would not be going to the blanking White House if they win it all. How much has that cast a shadow or maybe been a distraction on the World Cup?
I know for sure it hasn't distracted Megan Rapinoe. And for more on that, even though she didn't play, her partner, Sue Bird, penned a great piece that was out today. And I think that it's a good insight to the kind of resiliency that Rapinoe has. There's another article on ESPN about, you know, some of her family's background. And I think just the fact that what she said called attention to herself. It could be distracting to another type of player, but definitely not Megan. I've known her since she was first on the team, and she was in awe of some of the legends on the team at that time. But she was so eager and happy to be there, and has been nothing but incredibly loyal.
And now they'll be set up to maybe. Now they'll be set up to maybe win another title. That's soccer writer Andrea Canales. Andrea, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.
All right, now to home ownership. The Latino middle class in California is growing. Nationally, the poverty rate among Latinos is at its lowest recorded level ever. For many families, the road to financial stability has included real estate. But that path, that's becoming harder and harder to follow. Here in the first of two stories for the California Dream Collaboration, KPCC's Leslie Berestein Rojas introduces us to a family that's made it.
Oh. The Rivera family loves horses. Juan and Helen Rivera own several of them on a two-acre horse property in Chino, a suburb about 30 miles east of Los Angeles. Juan pets a horse named Zingaro.
A friend of mine brought him from Spain.
You might say the Riveras are comfortable. They live in a modern Spanish-style three-bedroom that they designed themselves. There are stables out back and grounds lush with purple jacaranda. A convertible Mercedes sits in the driveway. Before this, they had a five-bedroom home with stables in La Mirada.
Neighbors just assumed that we were drug lords, and there was a rumor that came back to us. I was like, what?
That's Helen. She's an administrator with the county health department. Juan owns a welding repair business. Over the years, they've invested in rental properties, and it's paid off nicely. The Riveras are part of a growing demographic. Affluent Latinos, the children and grandchildren of immigrants who've worked their way up from blue-collar origins to the middle class and beyond.
We're seeing increases in socioeconomic attainment with each generation since immigration.
Jody Aegis Vallejo is a sociologist at USC. She says as the second and third generations come of age, more Latinos have become business owners. More Latinos are graduating from high school and enrolling in college.
It absolutely contrasts with the myths and the rhetoric that is out there.
For Juan Rivera, it began with his parents. They came from Mexico in the 1960s and eventually sent for their kids. They didn't have legal status at first. Both worked in a foundry that made aircraft parts. In 1971, they scraped together a $3,000 down payment and bought a triplex. The family of six crammed into the front house, a small two-bedroom.
My mom and my dad sleep in one bedroom, then my sister slept on the other one. We slept in the living room, the boys.
And they rented out the other units. And that's how the Rivera family began building their multi-generational wealth. Growing up in East Los Angeles, Helen Rivera struggled too. Her parents were U.S. citizens, but they hit hard times when she was a kid. Helen and her dad would go to the Central Produce Market to scrounge for food.
As a little girl, it was easier for me to go in under the trucks and pick up the potatoes that fell off the truck.
But in time, her dad earned better pay. He was able to buy a house.
They knew being homeowners, you gained a certain level of respect being a homeowner.
Reaching financial security took both Juan and Helen years and lots of work. Neither had a college degree. Helen worked three jobs at one point, including waiting tables. Juan was working as a welder when he bought his first home as a young man. Soon after, he was laid off.
So then I went selling oranges on the street.
But he kept on making those payments, building equity and capital. Over time, the couple started investing in property. Today, they own 26 units. These properties helped their daughter, Monica, go to college. She graduated from USC in 2012 with no student loans.
I believe that the American dream is to come to a place where you open up new opportunities, not just for yourself, but for your family.
Today, Monica has a successful career in real estate.
Had it not been for the road that was paved by my parents, by all of our family that came before us, I would never have gotten the opportunity to go to college.
Juan and Helen are getting close to retirement age. As Helen brewed coffee the other morning, Monica took mugs out of the cupboard. The family had them custom made in Mexico. On each mug are the words Rancho Rivera. They also have custom plates with a mascot of sorts, that caricature, the guy sitting under a cactus, him.
This guy is supposed to represent a drunk, so that's not like a real favorite thing of mine.
But Helen sees something else, a tired worker.
Resting from working the agave fields, from working in, you know, the fields, period, but working.
Working hard, which is what the Riveras say is ultimately the key to their success. In Chino, I'm Leslie Beristein Rojas.
Tomorrow we'll hear from families who are also working but can't seem to make the jump to middle class. We do live in an era of technology when sometimes you really cannot trust what you see with your own eyes. Now, these so-called deep fake videos are all over the internet. Now, California is looking to ban them when they depict political candidates, citing election integrity. But is this too close to being a free speech violation? Find out when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
you're all alone. And nobody calls you on the phone. Or don't you feel like a crime?
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The internet can be a tricky place. You have to have your wits about you, because if you don't, you might fall for something like this.
Working together to make pass that, not the three things.
That's a snippet from what's called a deep fake video, content that's doctored to portray subjects doing or saying things they actually did not do or say. Now, in this case, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is depicted stammering through a press conference. The video went viral after it was broadcast on Fox News, and President Trump shared it on Twitter. So California lawmakers have introduced Assembly Bill 730, citing possible election interference. The proposed legislation would prohibit the distribution of deceptive audio or visual media of a candidate running for elected office within 60 days of an election. Rebecca Delfino is a professor at Loyola Law School. She wrote an op-ed about this. Rebecca, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about deep fake videos. Why have they become such a concern lately?
They present a broad potential attack, both on our political system and then also in people's personal relationships. Any person that has a presence on the internet, any digital image, is susceptible to having another individual or an entity take that image, that remark, that comment, and to manipulate it, to doctor it in a way to create a false image that the observer would not be able to detect is actually false, because the AI technology that's being employed now is so sophisticated that the naked eye can't observe and discern what is false versus what is real.
You mentioned how sophisticated the tech is. Is that software to create these deepfake videos easily accessible?
It's easily accessible to the point that there's now an application that one can download onto their smartphone and create a deepfake. Now, a lot of these are relatively crude, but the application allows someone who's not going to really stop and look at it, they're not going to recognize that it's fake.
Now, lawmakers say the main reason for AB 730 is election integrity. Can you explain how deepfake videos might compromise elections and how this bill could stop these kinds of videos from spreading?
AB 730 is directed at maintaining the fairness and the security of elections. You know, if properly employed, and it would prohibit individuals or entities or committees from creating false images of candidates by either adding words that they didn't speak or picturing them in events or in situations that don't accurately portray them, on the one hand, to harm their possibility of being elected, or to help them be elected.
And how would this bill then stop these kinds of videos from spreading?
Well, the intent is to allow either a registered voter to seek an adjunctive relief to prohibit the distribution of the audio or visual media, or allow the candidate that was targeted be able to bring an action for damages against the individual who disseminated the images. And so it's both for voters and for candidates.
Talking to Rebecca Delfino, professor at Loyola Law School. Now, the California Broadcasters Association and the California News Publishers Association have come out against the bill, saying it interferes with the First Amendment. What's the argument there?
There's several arguments that center on the way that the bill has been constructed. And one relates to what we were talking about a moment ago with respect to the timing. One of the arguments that's been made is that it's not narrowly tailored given the timing. So if the idea behind this bill is to ensure fair and secure elections, then creating this 60-day window within which liability would arise doesn't really ensure that, because in both injunctive relief and claim for damages really can't be achieved within that time frame. And so it doesn't really promote fair and secure elections.
AB 730 also aims to have audio, video, and photographs disclose when they have been manipulated. Why has this point about disclosure gotten pushback?
So it doesn't distinguish between manipulations of audio and video that are minor and immaterial and unrelated to what the candidate is doing, and those that are material. So the one example in the critique is that a candidate corrects an image of themselves, say, to remove red eye or, you know, correct the color of their teeth, something that's entirely innocent and not related to their message. Well, that would be prohibited under this statute, as much as someone taking that candidate's face and putting it on some negative image. And then one of the other, I think, troublesome aspects that's been raised is that this is essentially a strict liability offense. And what that means in this context is that one could be liable for knowingly or even recklessly distributing or sharing the image, even if you, as the distributor, don't know that it's a deceptive image.
So if someone posted it on Facebook and I shared it innocently, I could get in trouble.
You could be sued for damages by the candidate, or you could be on the receiving end of an injunction. And that's troublesome, because even if somehow you could manage to win, the problem is you still have to defend yourself.
Yeah, and pay all that money and everything.
Yeah.
Now, media literacy has also been a big topic lately. So how about that, Rebecca? How about viewer beware? Are there any skills the public can hone to maybe more easily spot these kind of videos?
One of the major skills that anyone can employ in this respect is just skepticism. It is my impression that individuals do spend sufficient time researching, for example, what refrigerator to buy or what car to buy, and we take time to invest in those research opportunities, and we take skepticism about claims that relate to other areas of our consumption. But when it comes to the political realm, it appears as though in the last several election cycles, folks aren't applying that same level of scrutiny to what they see on the internet.
Yeah, consider everything. Like, where are you watching it? Who posted it? All that stuff. You know,
right? And to check other sources, just like you would if you were buying a car or a new refrigerator.
Now, a first attempt to regulate these deepfake videos failed, and this new iteration, AB 730, is drawing lots of criticism. So, Rebecca, what's the solution?
The solution, I think, is to invest more time and effort in voter education. So because political speech is so important to our democracy, it is an area that we should really tread lightly before we regulate. And so rather than create measures that would limit speech, I'm more in the camp of the best remedy for speech that is false is speech that is true. That is part of our constitutional tradition in the area of the First Amendment, is to allow for more speech and more engagement on that level. That is the true way to combat this.
Rebecca Delfino is a professor at Loyola Law School. She spoke with us today about the repercussions of a potential deep fake ban. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
All right, to a climate issue now. California has a number of military bases right on the coast. Vandenberg Air Force Base, Point Mugu, San Diego's Naval Base, just to name a few. But a new government report says many military bases aren't moving fast enough to protect themselves from the effects of climate change and sea level rise. And they aren't getting proper support from the Pentagon. Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project.
The report comes from the Government Accountability Office. It looked at a sample of 23 installations and found most hadn't used projections of climate change effects, such as sea level rise. The report said that planners on bases need more direction from the Pentagon. In the report's words, not assessing risks or using climate projections in installation planning may expose Department of Defense facilities to greater than anticipated damage or degradation as a result of extreme weather or climate-related effects. For many installations, that kind of damage isn't just off in some distant, nebulous future.
We're at the Farragut Field seawall on the campus of the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
Commander David McKinney is a spokesman for the Academy. Those thrumming diesel motors belong to three of the special 108-foot-long boats used to teach naval cadets skills like coastal navigation. Sitting beside a waterway is crucial for the Naval Academy. But that water also has become a threat.
What we're looking at right now are some sinkholes that have developed on the seawall that faces the Severn River. These have developed over time. The seawall's been in place.
In 2003, Hurricane Isabel flooded buildings on campus, causing more than $100 million in damage. That was such a big jolt that since then, the Naval Academy has taken some of the most aggressive steps of any military installation to protect itself from the rising water. The Academy created an advisory sea level committee and, among other things, drew up plans to rebuild this seawall higher.
We're going to take into account that the water level will most likely rise in the future and build it about 2.5 feet higher than what it's currently constructed, with the ability that we'll be able to even add height onto it.
The Academy also has designed a new building, not only to be high enough to avoid flood damage itself, but also to act as a flood control wall to help protect the campus. Annapolis has about 40 floods a year now, up from fewer than half a dozen just a few decades ago.
We encounter what we call nuisance flooding quite a bit, where when tides rise, it overfloods the road and you just have to deal with it.
Other bases, like Naval Station Norfolk, are taking even more elaborate steps. The world's largest naval base has been working closely for years with a host of partners on things like projects to protect key roads in the area, and it's been building new structures like barracks and piers higher. But experts agree with the GAO report that the military isn't moving quickly enough.
DOD is not adequately prepared for this.
Retired Marine Brigadier General Stephen Cheney is chief executive of the American Security Project, a Washington think tank that's been pressing for a more robust military response to climate change. Cheney knows one of the most threatened bases intimately. He once commanded Parris Island, South Carolina, the iconic Marine Corps training base for new recruits. It's expected to be exposed to significant flooding in the next few decades, and a senior Marine commander has said it may need to start building seawalls.
Parris Island's in trouble. When you've got various sections that are consistently flooded, combined with catastrophic weather, you can't build a seawall around that entire base. I mean, you're talking miles here.
Cheney says at least Parris Island can be moved somewhere safer because it doesn't have to be on the coast. That's not as easy for bases like Camp Lejeune, where Marines train for amphibious landings, or deep water ports like Norfolk.
Your coastline's going to erode. You're going to go underwater. You're going to have to find a way to get around it.
He says a big part of the problem is that the Trump administration has been downplaying the threats posed by climate change. Even as three bases are grappling with nearly $10 billion in storm and flood damage in less than a year.
It's been difficult to get them to even admit that climate change is causing destruction of major bases and interrupting training worldwide.
But the Pentagon did agree with the findings in the GAO report. Among other things, it said that it will begin providing bases with better guidance on which sea level rise projections to use. In Annapolis, Maryland, this is Jay Price reporting.
All right, moving on to health. Reports of elder abuse in Southern California are on the rise like never before. There are a number of strategies for making sure people don't fall victim to abuse, be it financial, emotional, or physical. KPCC's Michelle Faust-Ragavan reports there's one strategy you might not have thought of, making sure seniors have an active social life.
Lynette Kwan Soon is a vibrant 76-year-old mother of seven. She wrestles in her crochet bag to show me some of her work.
This is my top that I wore yesterday.
You added the crochet to
the bottom. I added the crochet to the bottom. And this here is the blanket I did.
Originally from Trinidad, she moved to Orange County a little over a year ago to live with her daughter. Kwan Soon comes to Acacia Adult Day Services in Garden Grove 3 days a week. She has a happy family life, but while her daughter and son-in-law are at work and her grandchildren are at school, she'd rather be here than home alone.
I need to be out, to be speaking with people.
Kwan Soon worries that if she spends too much time alone, she'll lose mental capacity, and research bears her out. Social isolation is not only dangerous to the health of seniors, it puts them at greater risk of elder abuse, says Dr. Mark Lax, chief medical officer at the New York City Elder Abuse Center.
Cultivating social relationships is probably the most effective and the most inexpensive, by the way, intervention, not only to prevent elder abuse, but to improve the quality of life for older people irrespective of the medical conditions they face.
Vietnam, Vietnam,
that's what Acacia Adult Day Services is trying to do. More than 100 older adults spend their days here getting physical therapy, exercising, making crafts, and singing.
Vietnam, hai câu nói sau cùng khi
like this group singing in their native Vietnamese.
That's one of their biggest things.
Jim McAleer is the president of Alzheimer's Orange County, the nonprofit that runs Acacia.
It's everything from karaoke to we actually have a choir director come in and lead some music programs. So it's a pretty robust set of activities.
There are a number of ways having an active social life can help prevent elder abuse. McAleer says when left home alone, older adults who don't have anyone to talk to could become more vulnerable to a scammer over the phone. About 5 miles to the north at the Senior Serve Adult Day Healthcare Center in Anaheim, Program Director Yesenia Ocampo says sometimes it comes down to having more people looking out for older adult safety. Ocampo says that's what her staff does.
They take them to the restroom and they are with them pretty much throughout the day. They are our eyes. You know, if they notice anything, they report it to us.
She says her staff pays attention to potential signs of neglect or abuse, things like bruises or signs of depression. If they have to make a report to authorities, they will. But Ocampo says it's more common for her staff to help family caregivers deal with the stress of being in charge of an elderly relative's well-being.
It's a lot of work, you know, as caregivers. So they do provide, like, resources for them. Oh, you can go here for help. Maybe they can provide you with assistance or support.
For example, Ocampo's social workers often connect caregivers with the training they need to do their jobs better. Back at Acacia, Jim McAleer says adult day healthcare is only one possible way to keep older adults engaged in their communities. He says they could be involved in social groups or church groups.
But at the end of the day, there's also a tremendous opportunity for our seniors that we're not capitalizing on. We're not using them as volunteers. We're not using them as the brain trust that they are.
Lynette Kwan-Soon is confident that she still has a lot to offer.
And old people is not garbage. I have all my things working up here.
And as she grows older, keeping community around her will help keep her safe and healthy. Covering health, I'm Michelle Faust-Ragavan.
All right, we all have political opinions. There are certain careers, though, where it's probably best to leave them private. For example, ideally, journalists. This way you can trust what they report. What about police officers? Can they have strong or maybe even hateful opinions about specific groups of people and still be expected to treat everyone fairly? Find out when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Where you lead me, you know I'll follow. Yes, I will. Whatever you tell me. I've been loving you, baby, for a long, long, long time, and I'm not tired. Honey, you know I'm not tired.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Law enforcement, including individuals at the LAPD, are members of hateful groups on Facebook. Now, that's according to a new story from Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's similar to a story we heard yesterday about a secret Facebook group of current and former Border Patrol agents who made troubling posts about migrants in the department's custody. To tell us more about what police officers around the country have been saying, we have Reveal reporter Will Carlos. Will, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me on.
The Facebook groups themselves have names such as Veterans Against Islamic Filth and Purge Worldwide. So let's talk about one person you found in your reporting, Sergeant John Valdez, who's with the LAPD. What did you find him saying?
We found John Valdez inside a group that's connected to the alt-right movement. It's a group called, and it's going to get a bit confusing, but it's called Anti-SJW Pinochet Helicopter Pilot Academy, which is quite a mouthful. But basically, this is a whole bunch of sort of trigger words, of dog whistles that are used by racists on the internet to sort of attract other racists and bring them in. And what we found was this guy posting numerous memes, mainly against the trans community. He would post sort of, I believe in one case he posted a sort of a vomiting meme underneath a news story about a trans woman. And this group itself is an extremely racist, Islamophobic, occasionally anti-Semitic, and definitely anti-LGBT group. It's a very nasty place to be.
What other examples of things that you found police officers saying?
So we found police officers from across the country posting, you know, anything from like really benign stuff to more racist stuff. There's a guy who we found in Texas who had actually posted this meme about an African-American woman kind of responding confusedly to a reporter's question, playing on the sort of trope of fried chicken. He actually ended up getting fired as a result of posting that and some other posts. But then we also found people inside anti-government militia groups, you know, organizing meetings, setting up to meet with other people. And we also found people posting really violent and nasty anti-Islamic stuff. A sheriff's deputy in Missouri who posted about the new head of the Democratic Committee, who is a Muslim, and he said, look who the Dems have now as their head, a raghead Muslim, which is the sort of typical of the comments that we found.
Well, how did you hear about these groups?
We talked with a researcher in North Carolina who's been focusing on Facebook for several years, and she got interested in Facebook actually in the run-up to and after the deadly Charlottesville protests in Virginia. And she started tracking hate groups, and she figured out that you could go to Facebook and Facebook would actually give you a list of everybody who's in these groups, even in the case of closed groups, which was a real eye-opener. She started tracking who the members of particularly nasty closed groups were, and she helped us to identify more than 1,200 extremist groups that we then looked inside for police officers.
And some of the closed groups made jokes about African-Americans, Latinos, LGBTQ people. Anti-Muslim comments were often posted openly. Why do you think that was?
I think, you know, the way that the researcher I just mentioned put it to us is she said it's the last accepted form of bigotry in America. And I think that's very true. The Islamophobic stuff, it was like they weren't ashamed of it. It was like it was acceptable. It was okay to do it. And you have to question, I think, given some of the things that the president has said, whether, you know, that's just a more accepted form of hate and bigotry. Although, of course, it is hate and bigotry. And we tried to really point that out in our stories.
Talking to Will Carlos, reporter with Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Now, you reached out to over 100 law enforcement departments to let them know what their officers were saying online. What did those departments say?
Well, we know that at least 50 departments launched internal affairs investigations into the conduct of their officers. Now, in many cases, what happened as a result of those or whether they're still ongoing, we don't know, because the moment they become sort of personnel matters, the department just won't tell us anything more about them. I mentioned the guy earlier, the detective who was fired. But then I've also had police chiefs in sort of small towns call me up and just abuse me over the phone and tell me to leave them alone and not to call them and to leave their officers alone. So it's been the whole gamut of responses that we've received.
What happened when you reached out to the people who allegedly posted these remarks?
I mean, a few of them were kind of, you know, recalcitrant and apologized and said, you know, I shouldn't have done that. But most of the guys that I spoke to were very forthright in saying there's nothing wrong with what I've done. And especially, I can have a political opinion and it doesn't impact my policing. It doesn't impact the way that I treat people. You know, I might write Facebook posts that call, you know, Muslims animals and filthy, but when I see a Muslim on the street or I have to interact with a Muslim as part of my work, I'm never going to let that impact my work. That's what I heard time and time again.
Now, what's been the reaction from those in the Muslim community, or maybe from lawmakers who've been the subject of posts from this group?
Dismay and not a lot of surprise, honestly. I mean, you know, I talked to Kasim Rashid, who's a Muslim scholar. He's also running for state senate in Virginia. And he said, look, I mean, this is just a reflection of the reality for American Muslims ever since basically 9/11 and probably before. You know, I mean, this is just the way that we are treated by obviously not just police officers, by civilians, and finding it very, very sad and very shocking that the people who are charged with protecting all members of society hold, you know, in some cases, very strong and very nasty views about a subset of that society.
Now, yesterday we spoke with A.C. Thompson, a reporter at ProPublica. He had a piece about Border Patrol agents who were posting pretty disparaging things about migrants in a secret Facebook group. Wondering, Will, what similarities do you see between that story and your story?
Well, I'm chuckling because, you know, good old AC, he beat me to that story. I actually had that story tip a couple of weeks ago and I couldn't get to it. But I see huge similarities. I mean, as far as I understand, that group was actually a secret group, which is one that you cannot even see on Facebook unless you're a member of it. So it's another level of hidden sort of secret messaging going on. But I think what AC discovered in there and posted was a look at the sort of the dark heart of ICE and CBP. I mean, at the end of the day, the people who work for these agencies are, you know, they're people, they're just like you and me, and they hold strong beliefs. And in some cases, they're not ashamed to talk about those beliefs. And in some cases, those are hateful beliefs. And we saw that in both his reporting and my reporting, I think.
That's Will Carlos, reporter with Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Will, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
We report a lot about the LA County foster care system. It's the biggest in the United States, so there are a lot of stories to tell you about. But up next, something a little bit different, a novel about foster kids written for preteens by a court-appointed foster care advocate. That's next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. MG Hennessy works as a court-appointed special advocate in the LA County foster care system. She's also an author. And with her new book, The Echo Park Castaways, she's combined the two in a novel for middle grade readers. It tracks the lives of four foster children who are placed in the same home and become a family of sorts. But I'll let her tell you about it.
I'm MG Hennessy. I'm the author of The Echo Park Castaways. I actually first became interested in foster care when I was researching a different book about 5 years ago. And there were a lot of things about the foster care system that I was completely unaware of, like for the fact that there are actually 30,000 kids in the Los Angeles foster care system, which is simply a staggering number. And so what I ended up doing was volunteering as a court-appointed special advocate, a CASA. And what that means is that I am assigned to one child for their entire journey through the legal system, which is usually about 2 years. And my job is to sort of supplement what their social worker is doing. For the kids, I really wanted to give a cross-section that would be pretty representative of the actual demographics that we have here in Los Angeles. So there's the oldest girl in the house is Nevaeh, who's 13 and who's very driven. She's African American and she wants to become a doctor. Like she has a very clear vision of her own path out of this system and how she wants to succeed in life. And then Vic is from El Salvador originally. He's Latinx and he is placed in foster care because his father was deported. And he has this very rich fantasy life. He has this alternate reality that he kind of exists in which he's a super spy, like a kid James Bond. And then Mara is the youngest in the house. And the final character, Quentin, is a young boy with Asperger's. The kids realize he keeps trying to run away, which is upsetting the balance in the house because their foster care mother, Mrs. K, keeps threatening to stop fostering children. And even though she is far from an ideal foster parent, she's actually pretty negligent. It's still one of the safer environments that these kids have been in. So in order to maintain the peace in the house, they decide to undertake a quest to help Quentin find his mother because they realize that's why he's running away. And along the way, they end up having this series of misadventures that brings them closer together and kind of creating their own found family. Echo Park just sounds kind of romantic, like much more romantic than it is in reality. And it's also an area that when I was writing the book was really at the early stages of gentrifying, which I thought was an interesting juxtaposition to kind of have this transitional neighborhood because these are kids in transition themselves. And so the neighborhood sort of reflects what they're going through. I like writing from the kids' point of view. I mean, it's a very close, you know, it's basically first person when you shift from child to child. And I think that for kids especially, what you're really trying to achieve is to give them a sense of windows and mirrors. You want kids who are like the kids in the book to identify with them, and you want the kids who aren't like those children to have a window into their lives. I'm a mother of two, a boy and a girl. And I have, you know, when my kids, they're a bit older now, but when I was writing these books, they were exactly this age. I mean, I kind of wrote these books for them in a way because I wanted to open up worlds to them that they weren't aware of. And so I think that voice was easier for me because I have those kids in my home and I know how they talk. And I know this with my own kids, it's tough sometimes to get them to read social issues books because they feel like work. You know, it's almost like adults with nonfiction. I mean, it's a tougher sell. And I think that the trick is to make it a story in the way that the best documentaries are a story, right? In that you're sort of swept along by the narrative. And I also feel really strongly, especially writing for this audience, that I want my books to end on a hopeful note. Not an unrealistic note, not something that's not earned, but I do want it to be hopeful because I know with this age group, my kids would absolutely not have tolerated an unhappy ending. They don't like that. They still don't like that, but at this age, they particularly did not like that. I hope that they walk away with the realization that, you know, there might be foster kids in their school, in their class, that they didn't even realize were in the foster care system or they had no real grasp of what they're going through. I mean, I think with the foster care system, so many of these kids, I mean, the statistics are terrible. Like, so many of them end up homeless or incarcerated within 5 years of aging out of the system. 75% of the girls end up pregnant at least once by the time they turn 21. And so a lot of these larger societal problems can be stopped if we actually help these people when they're children. And I think that the way to reach those kids and to help like an entire generation is to make people aware of this issue earlier and younger. Because, you know, I didn't read anything about this when I was a kid. I think the Boxcar Children books, which took place in the Depression, were the closest that I ever came. I had no idea growing up in my relatively sheltered existence that this population even existed. And so I wanted to make it so that these kids weren't people to be pitied also, that they were relatable and that they clearly needed some help, but that they were also capable in ways that other kids their age are not.
Sun is rising on another cafe, weekends in Echo Park.
That was MG Hennessy talking about her new book for middle grade readers, The Echo Park Castaways. And if you'd like to catch MG in person, she'll be at the Robertson branch of the Los Angeles Public Library on July 18th. Details are on the events page at lapl.org. All right, if you missed any part of the show, just go find us where you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.